That you do not know me. I'm professor at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I'd first like to thank Professor Jessica Lee and Professor Luna Lee and then Diamond Yuan as well as Bo Jiang for them to log in much earlier than I did to maintain the and try to manage this session. Here's how we're going to proceed. We're going to start with a group photo. As agreed among the three of us, and then followed by my brief intro for Professor John Braithwaite. And then it's the big event of John Braithwaite's speech. And after his speech, we're going to take another group photo just in case some people come in late, and then followed by Q&A session. So feel free. Someone has a question? Yeah, so please feel free to submit your questions to chat. But I would also like to ask you to take a note of your questions. So when we start the Q&A, I would like to just call your name and then you ask the questions directly to Professor Braithwaite so that we can have great interactions between participants and our speaker. All right, so let's get started. Professor Luna Lee, do you want to have us take a group picture first?
Sure, I'm ready. So is everyone
Okay.
ready? You
All
can
right,
turn
so
on
everyone, yeah.
your camera so we can see your pretty face. Let's take a picture, a group picture before the speech first. Ready? We have 47 attendants right now. So it's your own choice if you want to turn on your camera or not. Now I'm going to take three pictures. So this is the first one. One, two, three. Another one. One, two, three. The last one. One, two, three. Thank you all. We can start.
Thank you, Luna. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the ACCCJ keynote speech by Professor John Braithwaite. I'm Hong Lu. It is my great honor to introduce him. John Braithwaite is a distinguished professor and a world-renowned scholar in restorative justice. His work has impacted generations of criminologists around the world. John has received numerous awards for his work, including the Distinguished Criminologist Award from the Australian and New Zealand Society of Criminology, the Sutherland Prize from the American Society of Criminology, the Durkheim Award from the International Society of Criminology, and the Stockholm Prize in Criminology. I have known John for over two decades when I was a doctoral student at Arizona State University. I came across John's book on crime, shame, and reintegration at the time when I was struggling to find my voice. John's theory of reintegrative shaming had a profound impact on my scholarship on so many levels. It clarified the boundaries of law and norms, formal and informal social control, the effectiveness and limits of punishment, and the power of reconciliation and restoration. It was a huge light bulb moment for me to realize the importance of the context where punishment occurs, and more importantly, the value of comparative research. I was thrilled when he agreed to serve on my dissertation committee. I will forever remember John's humor and humility as a mentor, so much so that till this day, I imitate John's style when I mentor my students. Two memories stand out to me in particular. The first was when he suggested changing the designation in my research design. Instead of labeling two neighborhoods as neighborhood A and B, John suggested labeling them as the old and the new neighborhoods. John said that it would be easier for an old guy like him to remember. That was back in the 1990s. Another example is when John asked me for permission to cite the data from my dissertation. He wrote, I hope you did not mind that I would steal the thunder of your dissertation. With his unassuming nature, John lifted his students up and made us believe that we could achieve greatness like him. After decades of working in the field of criminology, John has not slowed down. He continues to publish and serve as a consultant for governments and institutions to implement his research findings into practice. So without further ado, let's welcome Professor John Braithwaite.
Well, thank you all of you for the kind invitation to speak to you. It's a great honor, and thank you for all coming, and particularly thank you to you, Hung Lu, for that generous introduction. And I must say, we are very proud of you as in terms of what you have done on that foundation of your PhD research over the last two decades. I've been writing a book called Macrocriminology and Freedom. Feel free to ask me to send you a draft if you'd like to offer any comments on what I have to say about China. I'm humbled to be speaking to an audience where, looking down the list of all of you, I'm confident that every single person in this Zoom knows a lot more about China than I do. But I will do my best on this topic. And as I say, you put my email address in the chat so you can write to me with any request to actually see the manuscript. I've always been interested in anime theory, in Durkheim, Merton, more recently, Messner and Rosenfeld's Crime and the American Dream. One critique of my macrocriminology and freedom could be that it does not make much of an advance over those scholars. One thing that's different is that it integrates explanatory theory and normative theory. I mean by explanatory theory, an ordered set of propositions about the way the world is. Normative theory, an ordered set of propositions about the way the world ought to be. I argue that you can improve explanatory theory by integrating it with normative theory, and you can improve normative theory by integrating it with explanatory theory. Now, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating, of course, with this work. One of the things that cross-national empirical criminology shows about crime and the American dream is that the American dream is not very American. Commodification, material ambition, supposedly distinctively American things in the writing of Merton, Messner and Rosenfeld turns out to be not distinctively American. Nor are commodification, material ambition, distinctively Chinese. Attitude survey measures all of these variables cross-nationally in the work of Chao Lukong, who's I think here in our audience, and his co-workers and others show that American and US attitudes are in the same range and that a number of other societies score higher than both the US and China on measures of the American dream. I think in Professor Chao's work on measuring Mertonian anime, Mexico and Brazil, maybe, are the countries that have the highest scores, and both the US and China are quite a way down that list. I used to say that Western schools were the mouse race that trains us for the rat race. Some say that's more true of Chinese schools. Yet Chinese schools don't seem particularly distinctive compared to the rest of East Asia. Amy Chu's work is very widely read these days on Chinese tiger mothers in child rearing, but are Chinese mothers more tiger mothers than other Asian mothers? I've got some Australian friends who are Aussie tiger mothers, I would say, and they're not ethnically Chinese. So the variation within countries on these matters is more profound than cross-national differences. Is everyone seeing me okay? Yep, everything's okay? Yep. We also shouldn't see Chinese capitalism as a unified thing. Chinese capitalism is highly variegated. The capitalism across the border from Myanmar in the poorer southwestern corner of China is wealthier when you go into China, but closer to Myanmar capitalism than to Western Europe, while some of the great industrial capitalist regions further to the east of China are more like European industrial capitalism of many decades ago. At the same time, the information technology, national security state capitalism of Beijing are more like Silicon Valley and Pentagon coordinated national security state capitalism. There's also a massive rural village agricultural capitalism. It's some kind of hybrid that I don't pretend to understand of a feudal past, a communist past, collectivization, modern agribusiness, state-owned corporations. Business in some pockets of China is more privatized and experiences less Communist Party micromanagement. There are free trade zones, which have no direct customs, lower tax, less red tape, supposedly unfiltered internet that approximates radically neoliberal market conditions. Chinese financialization by banks is massive, concentrated at nodes like Shanghai, and even less transparent than London and New York banks. The main point of all this is to say that variegation of capitalism within China is huge, and that's true within the United States as well. US capitalism is variegated in its own ways that both overlap and don't overlap with China's. And understanding that internal variegation in the US matters to understanding what differentiates Trump supporters from Trump opponents. American strategic thinkers used to think that as China and Asia more broadly became more market economies, communism would fall away. They would become more liberal, less authoritarian economies. In particular, Western strategic thinkers used to think that one day there'll be a big financial crash in China, and in the aftermath of that, China will become a democracy, just as Japan became a democracy after its defeat in World War II. China might actually be better able to recover from a financial or a pandemic crash than Western economies that suffer the knock-on effects on world trade from a crash in China. The authoritarian regime in China may well have better control of the levers to direct the capital investment needed to quell the crisis. After a crash on the Shanghai Stock Exchange, China might wobble a bit, 100 million people might lose their jobs, but the regime may be prepared to do what it takes to keep control of those levers. The regime might not fall. In contrast, elected Western governments could topple in response to a future crash that is bigger than past crashes, because China spikes down and does not save the way in the way China did save the day after the 1998 Asian crisis, the 2008 global financial crisis, and the COVID economic crisis, we hope. Some of those Western governments may fall into the hands of Trump-like authoritarian capitalism or an even more radical despotism. This risk warrants reflection, because trust in Western governments has been declining steadily across the decades since trust has been measured. Trust cannot decline forever without ultimately triggering political crisis. Real wages cannot keep declining forever as workers watch the rich become the super rich without this eventually catalyzing crises bigger than the Trump crisis. These are just some of the dynamics behind the empirical finding that economic crises destabilize democracies more than they destabilize more authoritarian regimes. As Van der Meer puts it, what stands out first and foremost from reviews of the evidence on the global decline of trust in governments is that political trust is highest in illiberal regimes such as Uzbekistan, China, Azerbaijan, Qatar, Singapore, and Malaysia. Their high scores are a consistent finding. While China is less buffeted by a blizzard of distrust than the United States, it is still vulnerable to those dynamics. There has been some decline in trust in China, and the decline is deepest in the regions where income inequality is most extreme, according to the recent 2020 study by Yong and Jin. Enough of the contemporary picture, let's go back in time. During the 1960s, the Chinese Communist Party used to invite Western leftists on study tours. They were not taken to see the ugly side of Chinese society. One virtue they'd report back from China's communist utopia was the low crime rate. They returned to describe Chinese cities where people left their homes unlocked, that they were so safe from crime. This was a story that had some validity in the 1950s and 60s. It was no longer true by the 1990s when common property crime had become more widespread. The homicide rate also went up by the 1990s. However, it fell quite sharply again, according to UNODC figures at least, from at a rate of 2.3 per 100,000 in 1996 to a homicide rate of 0.6 in the three most recent years, if we're to believe those UNODC numbers, and I'm interested in your opinions in discussion time on whether we should. There was more than a grain of truth to the low crime narrative for the Soviet Union as well in those immediate post-war decades. It was also, however, true that particularly under Stalin and Chairman Mao, the state disappeared a lot of people. And these states still do incarcerate large number of citizens to crush their political freedom or their political expression. My purpose in this part of the book is to show that both communist and capitalist societies are afflicted with ways in which unfreedom promotes crime and with ways that freedom reduces crime. In Stalin's time, in the Soviet Union, for example, the unfreedom of the gulag was structurally criminal, while freedom from unemployment, especially for women, and from homelessness, were forces for crime reduction. A widespread narrative of American Cold War commentators was, they would say, a high crime rate is the price we pay for freedom in America. In a society where people have wide freedoms to think and act however they like, many are bound to choose the lure of a life of crime. That's got a ring of plausibility, hasn't it? So it does as an explanation today as to why the United States has higher COVID deaths than China or Vietnam, say. Some freedom, you might also say, freedom to die an unpleasant death. My macro criminology and freedom book seeks to build a theory of freedom and crime then. A core claim of the theory is that high levels of freedom are key ingredients for low crime societies, especially for averting criminalization of the state and criminalization of markets. This was not an armchair conclusion. Throughout the 1970s, I worked on the relationship between inequality and crime. That led to a 1979 book, Inequality, Crime and Public Policy. Philip Pettit and I also developed a Republican normative theory of non-domination, a normative theory, a Republican theory of criminal justice. Freedom as the condition, that's about freedom as the condition of not being subject to arbitrary power of another. Freedom, if you like, as liberty, equality, and feminist fraternity. The French slogan, liberty, equality, and fraternity, but feminist fraternity was the way we thought about it. My early work made a case for the proposition that reducing inequality and reducing domination can help reduce crime. It also found that being a disadvantaged person and living in a disadvantaged community had a multiplicative rather than an additive impact on crime. Valerie Braithwaite and I followed up in a paper in the British Criminology in 1980 with some work, further work on the impact on homicide rates cross-nationally of years of incumbency of Social Democratic Party as opposed to conservative parties in the parliaments of countries. We also tested percentage of GNP spent on social security. Yes, it turned out that when Social Democratic parties had more years in the corridors of power, homicide was lower in those societies, and homicide was lower when the welfare state was bigger. The same was true for suicide rates. In 1980, Valerie and I also put the political freedom index into that cross-national regression. To our surprise, the correlation between freedom and homicide cross-nationally was minus 0.7. More freedom, less homicide. Perhaps our thinking was that this would be some kind of proxy for a competing neoliberal approach to politics to test against a social democratic politics. It turned out that social democracy, economic equality, and political freedom were all associated with lower homicide rates. These empirical findings from this era were inductive seeds that began to grow this macro criminology and freedom book. More recent analyses have mostly, though hardly consistently, but mostly supported an association between political freedom and lower homicide. A central argument of the theory of freedom and crime is the thin legal freedom of the kind we measured in 1980 does help to reduce crime, but much more importantly, thicker Republican freedom, conceived as freedom from domination, the condition of being free, not being a slave under the arbitrary power of another, that conception of freedom is more important to crime reduction. Key elements of that thicker Republican freedom are a legitimate normative order that's respected by citizens as an order that secures them from domination, a strong welfare state, labor laws, and redistributive tax policies that secure the poor against domination by the rich. Strong, plural, inclusive institutions that temper the power of other institutions in a robust separation of powers. I argue that the good society is a low crime society because it is a republic of strong individuals, strong families, strong civil society, strong community, strong financial capital, strong human capital, strong social capital, strong recovery capital, and strong restorative capital, where each of those forms of capital tempers the other. Each is a check, each kind of power, each kind of capital is a check and balance on other. So you don't want to weaken one in order to make the other strong. You actually want to hold all of them accountable through having all of them as strong as you can manage them to be. That's key to the normative theory being advanced here. Tempered, the idea of tempered here evokes the metaphor of tempered steel. When we temper iron to create tempered steel, we create an alloy. We mix the steel together with other metals, and this hybrid makes the steel more supple, yet stronger. It makes it less brittle, more responsive, so it can achieve its purposes as responsive steel with less brittle, more effectively than can an unalloyed steel. So the paradox is that by checking power and tempering power, you in important ways you make it stronger. The tempering of institutions means mutually checking other institutions against being brittle and corrosive, enabling them to be stronger at playing their part in the project of freedom in a republic. And I'm a great fan of Sun Yat-sen in this regard. He was a believer in a strong state. He was worried as a political leader about the criminalization of the Manchu state criminalization of the state by warlords. So he wanted to have a strong state, but at the same time, he was a part of that Chinese tradition of thinking about the state, that the power of the state is dangerous and must be rendered virtuous. So how do you do that? Return to that theme. Tempering also means checking citizens are not dominated. And it means that they temper other institutions, that all institutions temper other institutions, enabling other institutions rather than crushing them. My book argues for 150 propositions on the relationship between macrocriminology and freedom. I conceive them as a list of 150 tributaries to six proposed rivers of normative transformation. Naturally, the first is reduce all dimensions of domination. There's a tweak on Merton, Cloud, and Nolan here. When legitimate opportunities for freedom are open, when illegitimate opportunities to dominate others are closed, crime is reduced and freedom is enhanced. Domination is the more fertile concept for explaining violence than inequality. Militarized domination and criminalized domination of governments and markets are particularly critical. Yet markets against domination and discrimination must be, struggles against domination and discrimination must be contextually attuned, responsive to what are subjectively salient inequalities. Local micro dominations, for example, between warlords, landlords and peasants, can be more important to explaining violence than more macro or more national inequalities. So in the book, I talk about data from Nepal, where most traditional measures of inequality through Gini don't explain violence very well, but very local aggregations, local hotspots where there's extreme inequality between landlords and peasants is a very strong predictor of violence and terrorists by Maoist insurgents in Nepal. Because it's hard to predict which levels or kinds of domination will fuel raging fires of subjective oppression and violence and which will not, I argue that societies do well to aim at tempering all kinds of domination. It's common for multicollinearity to produce results that inequality explains crime, but not poverty, or not racial discrimination, or poverty explains, but not inequality and, you know, race inequality, or child mortality explains crime, but none of those other things. Often what's true in individual or ecological data is not in time series studies, or at least not true in time series with short lags. We do best to read these literatures with a spirit of openness to domination effects that are socially constructed as oppressive at different times, places, levels of analysis in different ways with different lags. We must be wary of selective positivism that after failing to find a particular linear effect empowers analysis paralysis over inequality and domination. Likewise, we need to be wary of the selectivity and attention to data of social democrats like me on questions of inequality. The second normative stream argues separate and temper powers, as I've said. This is for me the domain of both the greatest strengths and of Chinese political philosophy and its area of greatest weakness. I've often written that I see Confucius as the most important ancient philosopher of restorative justice. In my writing with Yan Cheng, for example, and Sun Yat-sen, as I've mentioned, I see as one of the great 20th century philosophers of social democracy. I'm attracted to Dennis Wong's way of thinking about Confucius. Wong and his co-authors commend a contemporary freedom-enhancing interpretation of Confucianism that sidelines his three bonds and emphasizes the five norms. These scholars want to replace the valorizing of Sun Gang with Confucian Wu Chang. Sun Gang refers to, excuse my Chinese pronunciation, everyone, my apologies, refers to vertical relationship of ruler subject, father, son, husband, wife. Wu Chang valorizes horizontal human relationships of the kind that are vital to deliberative democracy, relational justice, and to contemporary restorative justice in China, as in Ian's talk, as opposed to the vertical relationships of the three bonds. The key Confucian horizontal norms are yan, benevolence, yi, righteousness, which restorative justice theorists want to conceive, reframe as just relationships, li, respect, zhu, wisdom, and jin, trust. Trusting Confucian thought and contemporary Communist Party thought is a deep problem, as we've said it is for neoliberal thought. My book argues for enculturating trust, but also for institutionalizing distrust. Enculturate trust, but institutionalize distrust. And so does Sun Yat-sen argue for that, though not exactly in those terms. And that does mean a separation of power and of tempered power. Sun Yat-sen had a number of reactions in thinking about Western constitutional architecture. When he went to the United States, he, as a believer in democracy and thinking about how to constitutionalize Chinese democracy, he was very unimpressed with a lot of American politicians. He found many of them stupid, corrupt, populist. I'm not sure what he would have thought in the last few weeks if he'd been in the United States. And this caused him to reflect on the separation of powers. So you want a robust democracy that empowers the people, but it caused him to reflect back on the values of the examination system the examination system in traditional ancient Chinese culture. And also the idea of the control yuan. So the constitutional architecture in Sun Yat-sen's Republican constitution actually had five branches. It had Montesquieu's judiciary, executive, and legislature, but also the examinations branch, and the control yuan, and accountability and integrity yuan, if you like. And I think that was a really fantastic reform to have all sorts of institutions not sitting under the legislature, but sitting under an elected control accountability yuan that would be responsible for the Anti-Corruption Commission, the audit office, business regulatory institutions, and particularly for impeachment, not only of the judiciary as well as executive governments and presidents. The next stream of normative thought is strengthen the institutions of the market, state, civil society, and strengthen individuals. Institutional anomie theory is about the idea that we can reduce crime by strengthening non-market institutions like public education, public health. Commodification of too many things is a risk of American capitalism. Likewise, state control of too much is a danger of Chinese communism. My book does not see getting the balance right between market power and state power as quite the right way to think about this dilemma. Rather, what we need to do is think more like Sun Yat-sen on this matter and make both markets and the state stronger and more ethical, so both are better at checking and balancing each other as they both become stronger. And an important role for civil society in checking both as well. For example, in the United States, I argue that there's a clear need to better mobilize state power to protect public health and to impeach criminal presidents. Sun Yat-sen's constitution had a superior approach to impeachment than the US constitution. Markets also need to be more vibrant than they are, so they can check monopolies, check monopolies of tech giants, such as Facebook and Google, for example. Separated institutional powers must be able to pursue power up to the point where the power of one is not so strong as to overcome the power of the other institutions. Each separated power must be strong enough, however, to secure the exercise of its own power from being dominated by any other institutional power. So a central idea is that we need a normative theory that distinguishes markets in virtue from markets in vice. And that's a big part of the book. The idea is that if you make markets more vibrant, you get the more economically efficient production of goods, but you also get the more economically efficient production of bads. So we've got to have a conception of what are markets in vice and what are markets in virtue. And again, Sun Yat-sen gave quite a bit of thought in his constitutional design to that. The next principle is maintain a normative order that nurtures collective efficacy to resist domination. We're all pretty familiar, I guess, with the results of Rob Sampson and others on the strong predictive power, particularly in the United States, in the criminology of place, of collective efficacy in a place. And a lot of the work that we've been talking about today, well, your work, Hong Lu, on Chinese institutions like Bang Xiao, Ian's work on people's mediation. It was great to learn from Dr. Ling Xiao about Feng Chao, that's the best I can do to try to pronounce that. That sounds like another kind of institution which might be constitutive of collective efficacy with Chinese characteristics. Strengthen financial capital, human capital, social capital, recovery capital, and restorative capital so that each is checking the other. And the final principle is prevent wars before they begin to cascade violence, enemy, and domination. Countries that get themselves into a lot of wars suffer more homicides and more suicides as a result. Country that lives next door to countries that suffer very terrible wars also suffer more suicide and homicide. Homicide is something that clusters and cascades across space and time. And the very practical political objective is to keep out of wars. And this was important in Sun Yat-sen's social democratic thought, where he was very influenced by Gandhi in this, that he conceived of China as coming out of a period of a very bad history in the 19th and 20th century of violence, political violence surrounding the Manchu regime, then the warlord era, and then the Opium Wars and many other conflicts during that high violence period of Chinese history, so that a strong state is needed to end this period of violence. And then there's got to be this reset so that East Asia becomes one of the more peaceful parts of the planet, which indeed it has become, and that I actually think in my macro criminology is connected to the fact that it's a low, it has become moved, East Asia has moved from being a high violence region of the globe up to the mid 20th century to being a low violence region of the globe for more than half a century now. The reason my theory in macro criminology and freedom is an explanatory and normative theory of crime and freedom is that those six rivers with all their tributaries then converge to power a light on a macro criminologist's hill. And this light on the hill for me is strengthen freedom to prevent crime to strengthen freedom. And my hope is that that's a bright light on the hill because it motivates that fabric of 150 more specified propositions that weave together prospects for a republic that prevents domination. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Braithwaite, for an excellent talk. Questions? Let's see. Professor Peter Liu, you had a question?
It wasn't really a question, it was a comment, but you know, I may ask John to tell us what do you think about the difference between the Chinese dream and the American dream. And we know that the American dream has several very distinguished characters, like it has to be material goal, that has to be like everyone's interest in participation, and also it has to be on the conditions of open and individual competitions. So we like American dream because every individual has a place in this dream. But Chinese dream is different. We don't really see anything individual. And also this is collective goal for the society, for the party, for the nation. That's what the Xi Jinping's definition of a Chinese dream, I think. So when we talk about the American dreams, everyone says, it's a mixed blessing. On the one hand, it promotes individualism, it promotes competitions and achievements. But on the other hand, it also bring out the worst character of a human beings. People becomes greedy, people lose a sense of a community during the competition, so on. So it contributes to the crime problem in American society. And when we talk about Chinese